Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content and Exchange Wire, and I'm joined by Kieran O'Kane, our CEO. Good morning, Kieran.
Hello, Lindsay.
How are you?
I'm magnificent, thanks for
magnificent.
Asking.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, feel good.
I'm delighted for you.
Yeah.
Good. And our special guest this week is Simona Gentile, who is Global Digital Lead at Mindshare. Welcome, Simona.
Hello, guys.
Love
how are you
here.
Guys?
We're good. Very good.
How are you?
I'm happy and magnificent, as it said. Not really about the weather, but let's leave it like that.
This is going to be a very high-octane podcast.
Is this our first Italian guest? Before.
I don't feel like it. Maybe it is.
Have we had an Italian guest
maybe
before?
Maybe we haven't done.
No. Well, we love the Italians.
Yeah, we do.
Well, absolutely. Thank God.
Yeah. Full of life, full of beans.
Exactly. Yeah, here we go. Let's kick off. So our first story today is a mix of two stories, both focusing on a publisher theme. So the first is about the launch of Facebook's news tab and the news within that they will be paying a quarter of the publishers whose content appears on the news tab. The second one is related to the EU Copyright Directive, which is currently kind of being launched in France and Germany and being contested in France and Germany, with the news that Google is once again refusing to pay publishers to license their content. They are basically claiming that as a publisher whose news appears on Google News, you are on organic search listing effectively. And in search results, people do not pay to appear higher in organic search. They pay to appear as an ad. So as a search result, that we're not paying to license your content. Like, we're doing you a favor is effectively what they're saying without actually saying it. So basically, publishers are up in arms, and the authorities in France and Germany are contesting this. And then you have obviously the Facebook news tab trying to mitigate fake news by launching a news tab, and they're working with journalists and editors within Facebook to ensure that there is relevant content appearing on this news tab, completely different from what your news feed would look like. And I think something like the top 10 articles will be curated by editors, and it seems like they will be the publishers that will get paid, and then the rest of the content that appears on the news tab will be curated by an algorithm, but apparently hopefully a more effective algorithm than what the newsfeed uses, and those publishers will not get paid. So it'll be a similar kind of Google News-esque scenario. So I want to kind of first ask you both, kind of publishers go back and forth with their love/hate for Google. Like, it feels like a bit better devil you know. Do you have no choice but to work with them? Or can publishers, particularly the bigger ones, say, no, you know what, particularly the likes of Google, who are refusing to pay, you know what, I'm not going to give you a license to my digital content. I'm going to remove from you. I don't need you anymore. What are your thoughts on this? Simona, let's start with you.
So it's a big dispute, to be honest. And I don't think it's necessarily there is one right or wrong answer. So it very much depends on the consumer attitude and behavior and where they are actually, and where they're actually looking at these news or, you know, video. You know, it changed a little bit the approach to consuming, I don't know, content, which it could be video, it could be news as well. I do believe, I mean, for both Google and Facebook, without, you know, they're definitely, you know, the two tech giants, they set sometimes their own rules, and sometimes they're also against the, you know, the classic laws. But it's also true that lots of different website or different news, or for example different video companies, they had a chance as never had before to appear in this big social platform where there is a massive reach of audience, even their core audience, that they would never reach before. So I think it's how, you know, the industry has changed. I don't think it's just something that Google and Facebook should sort out for them, but it's also how this publisher should transform themselves. So what I'm saying, you know, at the moment, for example, when we look at print and press, you know, everybody is saying is dying because lots of people are actually using and consuming news and, you know, information online. And most of the time on this social platform or just Googling. So they might need to do some fundamental transformation in their industry, because it's fine if they, for example, now this news website, they just transformed themselves. They're asking some support based on a user's donation, right? Some people are actually asking for some subscription. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there is definitely a right or wrong answer. I think they might need to work out with, for example, the big publisher, they need to work with Google and Facebook to see, okay, this is the level of information that we might allow them to see if there is not a license fee or any sort of remuneration. And for anything else, when they go to the website, they would have to apply the same rules that there are for any other users. For the small publisher, for more small news company, I think being there is already a massive deal for them, so they should actually use it on their side in order to get more visibility and possibly more traffic to their website as well.
But so you work with advertisers. So yeah. If a publisher is saying that I do not want to appear on Facebook News Tab or on Google News because they aren't paying me, that will then mean there's detrimental, potentially detrimental impact to the traffic they're getting.
Yeah.
You as an advertiser wants to work with that publisher because they are getting an audience that you are trying to target. If they're no longer getting that audience, that could mean that you as an advertiser would go, well, I don't want to then appear on your site. I don't want to work with you anymore. So yeah. Could that, you know, yield is obviously very, very, revenue yield and traffic is a very, very important kind of trifecta that a publisher has to work with. Do you think that actually advertisers would look at that and go, well, if you're not appearing on Google News, then you don't mean anything to me because that is how you're getting your audience?
I think it could be that. I mean, it very much depends because advertiser can choose a particular publisher for some branding activation. So they would choose them wherever and whenever. Or it's just a publisher that it talks about news, you know, news that are related to their audience. But if they can find other publisher in a much higher scale, you know, and also approaching Facebook and Google, so having like an exponential reach, they would say, well, you know what, if you're not there, there are many other millions publisher that will be there.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, there is these things, this dilemma. And at the moment, the publisher seems to have, based on the structure, the current structure of the industry and the media industry, seems to have the weakest part, which is unfair in some way.
Yeah. Kieran, do you think the publishers are right to contest this?
No.
No.
I think they're wrong.
Interesting. I didn't think you'd say that, actually.
I think that if you look at this through the lens of where we are right now, right? Why the hell would a publisher give up free traffic, right? Because ultimately, if you look at it from where we're going as an industry, the move from the third-party economy to the first-party economy, where we know that the anonymized web will become worthless in terms of like revenue generation for publishers, right? Why would they take themselves out of the biggest traffic referrers in the world, Facebook and Google, right? Let's be honest here. To use a sort of not a very kind of Me Too term, but they're clock blockers, right? Facebook and Google are the clock blockers of the digital ecosystem. You cannot grow a business without either of them. They generate so much traffic. Publishers now saying, we want money from Facebook, Google for copyright. It's sort of bullshit, right? What's valuable is logged in users, right? So why not take this free traffic from Google and Facebook and turn it into something real, right? A check from Facebook and Google is not going to be long-term any value.
So you don't agree with the copyright directive?
No, I don't. I think it's bullshit.
But I should also clarify that it's not about publishers won't necessarily, well, according to what Google is saying, it wouldn't mean they would disappear from Google News, but it would mean that their visibility would be reduced.
Well, let's be honest.
They're saying it wouldn't affect rankings, but publishers, and frankly, I disagree that it probably would affect rankings.
Yeah, user experience, you want to see a pic and more information. That's like, I'm more inclined to click on something like that than just pure text, right? Because the text just gets lost in a mountain of
you
text.
Get a headline, you do not get a thumbnail or an image, exactly, you don't get a snippet.
When you've got like the UX of a search engine or a search page is like ads, 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 and then text sort of stuff, is like, I'm going to basically click on something with a picture and something a bit more information wise and maybe a snippet of article. I'm going to go to that article. I think this is short term thinking, right? From this is the unfortunate thing of publishers, right? They're trying to get, so they're pounding the flesh off Google, right? So they get the free traffic, but they also want the money. I'm going, that's bullshit, like, you know, because you're going to monetize the traffic. But the reality is, it's like, if you take yourself off the search engine, if you want to go that way, right, and say, I'm removing my details, how do you distribute yourself, right? Because none of the publishers in Europe, except for Axel Springer, have a news app, which is very, very popular, right, up there. None of them have a strategy. Apple own distribution on the app side. Google own the search distribution, and Facebook own the social distribution, right? So publishers need to get it out there, right? They need to get traffic. But the value is they need to convert that traffic into logged-in users, which they can then opt in for target advertisers, because that's what advertisers want, right? Like, a load of anonymous passerby traffic, which you can't target, which you can't frequency cap, which you can't run attribution, is worthless. Worthless. House ads, affiliate links, and shitty contextual, right? It's just got to go nowhere. Whereas if you logged in users, so I think this is short-term thinking. We need, like, publishers need to start getting ahead of this. The copyright law in Europe is just another example of shitty legislative oversight around this whole economy. They don't get it. This is nonsense. what are you going to do? Like, are you really going to cede all that free traffic to your competitors who just don't really care? Like,
well, you know? There's an argument that if you choose not to partake in this and allow Google to license your content, then your visibility will become severely reduced.
100%.
There's an argument to say that it could then propagate more fake news. There'll be a rise of smaller publishers that you know, are seeding misinformation, basically. Do you think that could be the case?
It's possible, but it's always possible right now, because I don't think even with the perfect algorithm, you know, on AI, they will definitely completely forget about the fake news or whatever passed, because, you know, we're talking about web. So everybody can write everything. And I don't think that is the issue. I do understand, and that's why I was talking about the transformation of the industry. I do understand when we talk about the Facebook news tab, I would say I think that should be there, because it's where people are and they are getting traffic, because from there they're actually getting a snapshot of the news. They go to the website, traffic.
Free traffic,
absolutely. Mm. When I look at the dispute in Google, I do understand the point of the publisher, because at the moment, Google, and to be honest, I love it as a consumer, at the moment Google, when you search for something, they gave you already a preview of your answer, or possibly the full answer from a website.
Yeah.
So what does for a publisher? If all the answer is there, people are actually don't need to click again to go to the website. So that free organic traffic is lost. They're not going to get anything. They're going to have just the news, basically the answer to that question on the Google search results. And they said, wow, okay, in this case, we are on the organic traffic. Nobody click on my website. Nobody came to my site. Hence, the traffic is going to go down. And if they're trying to monetize with advertising, they won't, because, of course, they will stay quite, you know, thin in terms of traffic volume. Hence, I do understand how they act. But actually, the point here is that they should start to work and understand and transform the industry, always with wonky things. What's actually the value for the consumer? If the consumer wants to get answer without clicking elsewhere, well, maybe you have to find different way to monetize your business. And, you know, we might have completely like a massive change in the industry, but that's not a consumer problem. I mean, the consumer value should be your key priority in order to be successful in your business. That's what I think.
I think that's, you mentioned consumer more just then than we tend to mention the word consumer in an entire year in this industry sometimes. And it is a valid point. And the reason that these directives and these regulations exist is largely is for the rights of the consumer. And that is kind of what I think the EU copyright directive is not trying to do here. It's trying to work for the rights of the publishers, but the publishers to be able to keep serving the consumer. At the moment, how can a publisher keep serving its consumers and survive if it isn't able to be paid for the content it's producing? And that, I think, is the argument here.
Yeah, but
yes, they're getting free traffic, but what are they then getting off the back of that?
Yeah, but
no yield.
Okay, but then Google can basically just, like, it's a kind of like a Russian roulette thing, right? It's like, you know, will Google back down? And it's no, I don't. Google will not back down, and they'll probably give rise to a bunch of new competitors. It depends how you see news, right? News, in many respects, is a commodity, right? And building a brand in news is hard because, like, a lot of news is kind of commoditized. It depends if it's right, left leaning. But, like, you could easily, if they're writing about the same thing, there's a way to, you know, to spin up fairly quickly article that looks similar to the other article. So I think that's probably the key thing here for news sites. Like, you know what I mean? You know, you could have a startup who just said, right, if all the big French and German publications are pulled out of Google, I'm going to spin up a new company based on this, and I'm going to make money off the back of the advertising. You know, but then they'll run into the same problems
as anonymized
web.
Yeah, right.
Right, because then they have to get users to log in. I think it's being able to sort of convert that traffic from Google into something meaningful,
yes.
Right? And that's the problem.
And that then doesn't mean, and the I guess one problem with Google News is that somebody is looking for one article, and on that one article they might read that and then never come back again.
The bounce rate in those is huge. Yeah.
So the answer is not to then fill the page with ads and put tons of other pages, because you can monetize that one article that person's read. It's to try to encourage them to read multiple articles.
Exactly. So it's almost like, it's not like, you know, the old sort of system of, particularly some of the sort of lab Bibles of the war and all those types of social-based sort of kind of sites, they use social media as a means to drive traffic to the site, and then they monetize the site with programmatic basing on it. That doesn't fly anymore, right? If you're going to get this free traffic from Google and Facebook, you have to have bonus content. Keep them engaged on the page. It's all about engagement, right? So it's going to have to get... The way the publishers think about the traffic is... Google, you're using my information to do it. I don't get that logic, because all Google is doing is sort of highlighting your content and driving people to the site. I don't see how that's copyright infringement. I just don't get that. Because ultimately what Google is it's a content recommendation engine, if you will, search engine. It's sort of flagging stuff that you or me or you, you know, what we want to read, and we click on that, right? And we visit the site. So
Is it content infringement if Google can make any money from it in any way? Like if you were to then steal a photo from your taken,
how much information?
Can they? I don't think they can.
But how much information am I going to get from like three lines from a feckin' article? That's like nonsense. Like I'm not like if Le Figaro did a piece about Mitterrand, right, about his financial activities in the 80s, and there's three lines, I'm not getting any information for that. Maybe Google will serve. Remember, Google serves ads, but they're not serving a CPM. They're all CTO. They're at a click to. They make money if you click on the ads.
Yeah,
right?
There's no display ads.
The logic here is all skewed, right? If Google was now like showing snippets,
but the EU, the copyright directive isn't looking at that though necessarily. It's not looking at what Google's skin in the game is necessarily. Arguably, for the first time, probably it's looking more at the publishers are giving their content away for free, and they should be paid for that. So I don't think the directive really actually looks at the intricacies of how Google's making money out of this, or what Google's skin in the game actually is, which arguably is something that maybe they should do, because then you could argue again that Google is performing some kind of public service for these publishers.
I'll tell you what would be very useful. Publishers should go to Google and say, look, we will work with you. We want you to be successful, but we would like you to pass some information to us, right? So keywords, search keywords would really help. Think about it this way. If a Guardian user searches for, I don't know, micropayment solutions or something, I don't know, whatever story it might be, and that they click on that article and they come through, if Google could pass that keyword into the Guardian could then use that keyword to sort of highlight other articles similar to that. That would be really useful. I think that the whole mindset is wrong around this, because I don't see the logic of this copyright thing. Google is not taking wholesale articles and making money off the back of it. That's nonsense, because they're not. Logically, if they were serving display advertising and it was a CPM basis, I would probably say, yes, you owe those publishers money. But they're not. They're all click-based ads. So Google only make money when someone clicks on those ads. You know, so it's a mute point. But the publishers need to start thinking...
It's a mute point.
Obviously, you know...
Mute as in you should become mute.
This is my second language, obviously. English. My Irish language was killed by the invading English many years ago.
Tell me about it.
It's funny. It's unbelievable that I'm defending both Google and Facebook, but I actually think that they're innocent parties here.
Yeah, okay, interesting. Well, I mean, we could talk about this. We've talked about it too much now because you've gone on a rant again. But in favour of Google this time, which is a surprise for all of our audience, I'm sure. But this is a battle that will rage on. As I said, the authorities are involved when it comes to in France and Germany. So we'll see what the outcome is.
They're picking the wrong fight.
No doubt we'll talk about it. Yeah. Well, no doubt we'll talk about it again as more developments happen. Yeah. But on to our next story, which is a change of tack entirely. So McKinsey, the consultancy, is going to open up a store selling makeup and jewellery and underwear in Mall of America.
Underwear, yeah.
Yeah, underwear. Like that got your attention.
And there are many other things.
I love
as well.
What got your attention there. I meant underwear.
Selling me underwear.
Clearance going underwear. Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, nice.
Well, anyway, do you want to know why they're doing that? No.
Go ahead.
Okay. So they're opening a stall in Mall of America, and they're working with some big brands, including DTC brands like Third Love, to help their clients understand shopper behaviour.
Which clients?
Well, clients like Third Love.
Are they a client of McKinsey's?
Yes. Well, right. So we'll go into what it looks like. But it's basically, this is to gather data. There's a data gathering exercise, working with brands that they work with, like the likes of Third Love. And I think there's a jewellery company called Kendra Scott. And they're basically bringing them in this massive 5,000 square foot space that used to be owned by Abercrombie and Fitch, that they're basically allowing different sectors, different shops to open up in there, a bit like concession stores, to basically, and McKinsey are tracking everything to get different data. So those brands that are in there, it's cost them a lot of money to go in there, but they're saying it's worth it for us to understand our shopper behavior better and to work with McKinsey to understand it. And McKinsey is also gathering all that data, compiling it together and using it for other clients as well to help understand in the age of e-commerce and the age of the likes of Amazon controlling everything, what does the future of physical retail look like? How can we improve physical retail for shoppers? How can we improve footfall? How can we make physical retail a place where shoppers still want to come to? So they're using things like, for example, payment options in this store will be like paying my cryptocurrency. So there's all these different things. They're trying out everything. They'll be trying out AR, VR, whatever they can to get as much data as possible to then be able to help their customers understand shoppers and then use that over time.
That's cool.
I think it's fascinating. What a way for a consultancy to go.
Right. What does the agency think of that?
Yeah, Simona.
So, when's your pop-up store coming, Simona?
So, I mean, I have a very strong point of view here. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, for a consultant and for an agency, I admire the braveness and the courage to do something like that. I can get why they're doing it. I don't necessarily think that they're doing to save brick and mortar or all the physical retailers, because I don't think that's their mission anyway. They're not going to get paid for that. I think they're doing it, and the mission is to gather that data and possibly have an added value and competitive value compared to other consultants agents or media agency, which is fair. Not sure how much scale they can get from that, because, of course, apart from the big boom or the opening of these of this store, it's not going to be as the data that Amazon can gather, you know, everywhere in the world.
No, I think that's a really actually interesting point, because Mall of America, while the footfall of Mall of America is huge, it is one subset of America and an even smaller subset of the world. Yeah. So you can get data and it will help understand a lot of what's going on, but it's going to be quite limiting in terms of demographic, right?
Correct. And plus, I'm an online shopper. I hate to go to the mall. I'm sorry.
I'm with you there, Simona.
For me, the main things that, I mean, the big feature is the convenience to be at home and choose whatever I like. And all the digital process, you know, the convenience, the fast things, you know, the fact that you don't have to move your ass from the sofa to do whatever you want and order whatever you like. The fact that you can return anything that you buy, even a free cost, delivery costs. So everything related to e-commerce and also digital technology, you know, everything that they do, you know, now they can possibly use VR, augmented reality, whenever we do anything on e-shopping is there. So why I don't think this is a good idea to save retailers is because whatever they're doing right now, if you look at what they said they are doing, they are using lots of technology, AI, smart mirrors. Smart mirrors is something that any website can do online. And how can you possibly see that a small retailer could use all this technology, could pay lots of money to engage with a new consumer? I don't think the approach to that. I don't know if retailer will exist in the long term, but if they want to do something, they need to find, I think retailer need to find a different way, possibly gathering data, possibly do some study, but try to understand and transform their business to understand what is still the added value that can they provide and e-commerce cannot do. For instance, I'm an environmentalist. And I do believe that, you know, whatever I order, you know, all the postage and, you know, the delivery things that I do, they can possibly have an impact. I think retailer could play a massive role if they do something at kilometer zero, for example. That's just completely an idea that I had in my head right now. But or what is actually something, the experience, the retailer experience, which is not replicable in an e-commerce space? What is the things that actually a customer can look at when they go to a store? That's how they should approach it. I mean, cryptocurrency is more, it's all great. It can be a wow approach for people that are curious and say, okay, I need to go to this cool shop. But the other brick and mortar, the other retailers, like independent retailers, they will never compete with technologies like that. So I don't think it's the way to go to save brick and mortar. I think it's just a good opportunity to see the consumer journey. If people are approaching, I don't know, shoppers or website, search results, shopping results online, and then they can go there. I mean, they can do all this stuff. I don't know how they can approach technology and how they can bring the user journey from digital to the store, but they definitely can get some insights now. How can it work with all the retailers in the world? I don't know, and I don't think it's the way to go. I think they just need to, I mean, the retailer business, they need to transform completely how to approach the stores.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Kieran, what's your take on this?
I love the idea of a pop-up store for DTCs. I don't know if McKinsey's got a plan here, because I agree, the future of retail is not bricks and mortar. The future of retail is experience and online, right? So,
but bringing that experience to bricks and mortar, which is obviously what McKinsey is exploring.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think,
and what we've seen the likes of Farfetch do very well as well with physical retail.
If you think about DTC brands, there's thousands of them, right? So they may have a product coming out every year, or it depends on what type of business it is, right? If it's a makeup brand, it might be every year, or you know, specific sort of. So those pop-up stores around key hubs in the US or key hubs in Europe would be really cool, because then you could have an experience for like 6 months where you open a store in these sort of like, you know, these discovery portals, if you want to call them, like, you know, consumer discovery, and you could have, you know, a hub here for like a Hoover manufacturer, or a hub here for like a bottle manufacturer or whatever. And I think that's the future of retail for me. The direct-to-consumer thing is the way to go, right? I think people are just not going to go, but the stores become experiential type of thing. And maybe that's what McKinsey's trying to get out of it. Are consumers really, is this the future? Like, they want to see the data, right? When they see things, I don't know what the process is. Maybe you won't be able to buy stuff there. You just go and test it and say, well, if you want it, you can go online. Here's our app, or here's how you buy it. So
it would be a massive pain in the ass for me. I mean, I'm going to the store and then you're telling me, if you want, just go online. No, man, I don't want to go anywhere else.
Maybe a lot of shoppers kind of want to experience this stuff. And like, it's like, I don't know. I've never bought like makeup or perfume. Like, I don't really know anything about that. But I'm sure you want to try it on and look at it and all that kind of stuff. Or new Hoover. Like, that I'd buy into that. Like, but you want to test it out. There it is. You know, it's amazing. So I mean, you know, this podcast going sideways. I'm gonna get a few.
I can't even.
Litigation.
How life changed when you grow up
from makeup to Hoover.
But my point is that I like this. This is going to be the future of retail, because I think you're right. These scale bricks and mortar stores are going to not be fit for purpose anymore, because the experience in buying and exploring stuff is going to be online. But there is definitely a market for experiential thing. And actually, we've talked this before on the Retail Tech / DTC Daily podcast, when we said that the future of retail is about experience, right? Mm-hmm. It's not going to be about long-term leases and, you know, bulk buying and presentation, because people don't do that. I mean, like, fast fashion is a thing at the minute, but there was a survey out saying that in 5 years it'll be secondhand fashion. Like, it'll be like, you know, that retail experience is definitely changing. And this is quite interesting. I have to plug McKinsey. This is quite interesting what they're doing here.
Yeah, so then I guess, what about McKinsey in all of this, and kind of what their approach as a consultancy? Like, it's an interesting way to approach how you are working on strategizing e-commerce for your clients, right? Yeah. Will we start seeing consultancies and maybe even agencies, when you're trying to work out how you can help your clients grow as they're becoming more outcomes-based businesses and aren't just looking at brand building or brand awareness, but looking at how they can deliver increased football into a store?
You know it now.
Will that we start seeing other big kind of strategy companies start trying to do the same thing and actually go say, we're going to go all in and help you figure this out physically?
Do you think that McKinsey, maybe the agencies, start buying or leasing retail space to help their clients do experiential stuff across the US, and it almost becomes a business? I mean, I'm just kind of, you know, because it's like, is that something they would even go into? That could be an interesting sort of, because it feels like McKinsey's obviously trying to move into, we're going to own the DTC relationship because we know how they do it. So I don't know. Is this a model? Did they want to get into that business? I don't know.
Maybe.
I think I agree with you. I mean, it's a possible tactic, because I mean, they have lots of potential client interested into retails. I mean, it's all about profitability, right? I don't think they did a massive job there. Don't get me wrong. I think it's admirable. And I know they have done lots of work, and they actually very much cooperated and collaborated with the shops there and with the American Mall, which is amazing. But I truly believe that behind the scene there is a big plan.
I think so too.
I agree.
So the big plan is possibly they are seeing that footfall actually or retailer is the way that they're going. So again, they want to be like the first. They want to be the pioneer there. They actually did a massive things, and definitely they're going to have an exponential popularity for that. If other agency will do that, well, maybe in different way and forms they will do. Very much depending on where the agency or the consultant company want to go. I think that's the main point.
Yeah, fair is enough. I think start things to come.
I'd love to see with them business model. It'd be really interesting. Do they see themselves as the experiential channel, right? So maybe they were renting spaces on behalf of the clients. And with this data from this first iteration, they'll go, we know what works and what doesn't work. Let's do this across. And it's another sort of element that they can add to the consultancy layer, like, you know, because of this data here. Do you know the way, like, they have their channel, you know, their channel partners with Oracle? Maybe they do a similar thing with other retail owners across the US, but then sort of help the DTC brands build out their sort of, like, experience in those stores and charge a fee for that. I mean, that could be it. I don't know. I could be two steps ahead here, but it feels to me there's a trend. They're looking for the next sort of thing, because I think the retail, the actual supply chain is breaking down. Retailers are becoming irrelevant in many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Right. Well, before we move on to the third story, in this train wreck of an episode, I've been informed by Soundman Rodney that we've run out of battery on our sound recorder because somebody, me, left the power cable at home. So we're going to have to cut before we replace our batteries. And we're back shortly. Stay tuned, guys. Right, and we're back. So we were about to go into our third story,
right?
Which is the news that Oracle Data Cloud has cut some staff as it tries to move beyond third-party data. So it's announced it's cutting 10 to 15% of staff in Data Cloud, not in Oracle generally, in a move to focus on contextual data, brand safety, and measurement. And while the third-party data business still makes up a significant portion of revenue and they believe it will be a cash cow for a long time to come, they're obviously aware that the future of it is in question and they need to be investing in smaller, high-growth areas, and they will be using this money they're saving in staff to do so. And obviously, kind of when you hear the words contextual data, brand safety and measurement, you're thinking, well, there are three big companies they've acquired in the recent past that will definitely make up kind of what their future looks like, which is the likes of Grapeshot, Blue Kai, Moat, and all the other acquisitions of the past few years. So I want to get your perspectives on if you think this is a smart move for Oracle Data Cloud to basically admit and accept that we have to look to the future and third-party data is not it. Kieran, I'm going to start with you. Don't get ranty.
Don't get ranty. How do I not get ranty on this subject? Is this a indicative of where we're going? 100%. We are, as I said before, we're now moving from a third-party cookie economy to a first-party economy. And this is just a good example of where companies are thinking of this. I mean, it's right for Oracle to purge its third-party business because its fine would be absolutely humongous, 4% of revenue. And
I mean, I must say they are not purging it. They still believe it will be a significant portion of revenue in the near future.
Not in Europe. They've sunsetted Addis and a few, and Datalogix is a third party business. So my sense is that they're getting ahead of themselves here, which is a good move. I don't know. It's interesting. They're almost like devaluing their ad tech business, and they're saying it's not worth it because we're a huge company, we make money elsewhere.
But they bought Grapeshot, they bought Moat. This all been building up to this point.
They've
been waiting the wings for a long time. They're now being kind of brought into the proper fold of ODC. So
I think Oracle need to have a proper think about where the industry's going. I don't think those companies are going to be enough for them to build serious revenue. Like, if you look at... okay, so if it's contextual, yeah, fine. But contextual is not going to fill the void that third-party targeting has left. Is going to leave behind. Let's be honest, right? So we're right.
But also, there's still a role for third-party data if it doesn't involve third-party cookie as well.
Yes.
So Oracle have a lot of that, a bit like LiveRamp in that sense.
Yes, but you still need an infrastructure, a first-party cookie, to make that work. So, you know, if you look at Addis, which was a good example, they bought that for nearly $1 billion. And all Addis was doing was it give you free stuff, which was like, you know, the social shares thing. But it was literally throwing off like 60 pixels on your page. One stage we did an audit right before GDPR, we ripped them off. There were like 60 vendors appearing in a ghost here. I was going, how is there 60 vendors? We got like 3 tags on the page. So that type of business is what they had as their core. So that won't fly in the GDPR privacy force era. And we're in a funny, this is sort of a microcosm where we're going to go as an industry, because we're in a funny space here now where there's still a lot of companies sort of working on legitimate interest as being a basis for privacy in Europe and the US. That won't fly anymore. The ICO has flagged up that they're going to find somebody big in the first quarter next year. And that's when the privacy shit hits the ad tech fan. And in fairness to Oracle, they're doing the right thing here, I think. And we'll see other big companies making this move. We've seen a complete reorg of the Google ad business really recently.
Absolutely.
They paused a lot of long-term double-click people and basically moved that all into the ownership of the AdWords team. And now they have a whole privacy unit as well. So we're going to see a lot more developments here. I think Oracle is sort of the first company to make this move, and there'll be a lot more to come.
Simona, I'm interested in your perspective from agency land. Kind of, if you're seeing that the way, obviously, the Oracle and similar competitors to Oracle kind of are partners of yours, and you're obviously working with them across your clients. If you're seeing that the way that they are talking about data and the way that you're communicating with them, particularly as it pertains to your advertiser strategies when it comes to third-party data and first-party data, how that is evolving?
So, I mean, first and first, I completely agree with you. I mean, Oracle, I think it's possibly the first brave company that is talking about, okay, so this worked in the past, but now it doesn't work anymore, so we have to change it. You know, in the era of GDPR, e-privacy, but again, these are things that are going to affect also the global ecosystem. I don't think this is just something that is going to stay here. Talking about third-party data is not working anymore. I do remember that, you know, in the time of GDPR, the introduction of GDPR, everybody was freaking out. And I was actually the person that every time that I was meeting a publisher, I was always talking, okay, what's your position on GDPR? And especially, I mean, I talked to LiveRamp. I never met Oracle, to be honest, in the recent year. But I was saying, so how this is going to actually affect your business, and not just, you know, the scale of it, but actually your business. And nobody was actually, I mean, they didn't know at the time. Nobody had the bravery to discuss that. So I think already at the moment, most of the advertisers are not so much happy to use third-party data for all these legal reasons. I mean, they're all scared. They're all freaking out, advertiser included. The only way where we are actually still using third-party data is when, like, for example, a specific advertiser. Let's talk about, for example, luxury, a premium luxury business, right? For example, cars, automotive. When they're actually getting people with a certain level of, income or something like that. In that way, yes, actually, it still makes sense to have third-party data, because with contextual or whatever other way of targeting, you're not going to get the people right. But in a era where cookieless, to be honest, cookies are losing very much importance, and we're going to go cookieless environment, all first-party data, we're talking about users rather than a cookie, this is going to lose so much importance. There is a massive, for us, a massive topic right now with all the advertisers, but also in our media ecosystem, is to how to address cross-planning and cross-measurement. Mm-hmm. And this will all affect how we are going to plan from TV, from even print, you know, all the offline, the traditional offline channel to online. And all these changes are massively impacting the way that we buy digital and the way that we see data and which actually what is the necessary data that you can buy, what is the one that actually doesn't make sense anymore to buy. So that's how we're going.
Interesting. So we think that actually what Oracle is doing, they're doing the right thing. They're realizing that the writing's on the wall for third-party data, but actually they should be doing more than what they are. Is that what you both agree with that?
They need to transform. Again, it's all about transforming now their core proposition. It cannot be any more third-party data if there is, I don't know, anything else, what they can do in order to make it up. More what they can do. I think it's also about, again, looking at regulation, looking at the value exchange for a consumer to give you the data to search for some, you know, to get advertising. But it's more about, okay, where the industry is going and how we can tackle it. They might need to do some partnership. Again, when we talk about these changes are not like, these are drastic changes. This is transformation rather than change, actually, I would say. Exactly. It's not something that you can do from a day to another. It can be very expensive. So you might need to find a way to turn this around, having a partnership with other players like you, how this company, how these industries, where actually this industry is going, what we can do together in order to make it happen and have a piece of that remuneration cake for everybody. Otherwise, they're going to, I mean, it's like Blockbuster. It's like, I mean, the industry is changing as the consumer are changing. So they just need to be on top of it. And that's it.
Do you think Oracle Data Cloud could go down the LiveRamp route? I can't speak today, honestly.
Yeah.
LiveRamp route of maybe looking at their third-party data onboarding and actually creating their own unique ID for this data as well. And looking down, okay, well, this is what the future of the industry could look like as a MarTech company fundamentally. Actually, we should be playing in this game too.
So Oracle should buy LiveRamp.
Okay.
Right, not build it, just buy it, force that, and then buy a bunch of other stuff as well. I mean, I think the Oracle still have an appetite to be that, you know, that buffer between the CRM and the execution layer, right? And they would like that. They're a brand first product, right? Let's be honest with you. That's their proviso, right? And LiveRamp is a very, very good solution for them, and that's where they should be buying. I think that's who they will buy. There's no doubt about it. That's a $10 billion acquisition there, straight up. It will happen in the next 6 months because Oracle said, "Well, we need to own this because we want, as you say, we need to own that ID, right?" And LiveRamp will be an ID currency for the 20%ers outside of the walled gardens. We need a unified ID. I would prefer if Oracle did own that, because they're not involved in media. They don't have any skin in the game. It would be actually quite good for them to own that. I have no problem with that at all. It's hard to know. They're going to make more acquisitions. I think they've realized there's a huge opportunity here, right? If someone owned, remember, we're in this transformation process where nobody can tell the future. Nobody knows what way it's going to happen, right? We know for sure that the way that the industry has been set up around the third-party framework doesn't work anymore and will not work. It doesn't work in Safari, doesn't work in Firefox. Chrome is holding us all together because Google's afraid of moving left or right and annoying the antitrust crowd, right? But they're also constrained by the privacy piece as well. They can't not do anything for the fear of being broken up in antitrust. Antitrust thing's going to happen regardless of what their privacy piece is. And there's a bigger threat of them getting fined in the meantime by you think. So Google for me are the one company in here that is sort of holding the current framework together. But we need to get ahead of it. And I suppose Oracle has taken the brave decision to say, well, look, we know this is shite. It doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work. It doesn't work across Safari, which is 40% of traffic in the UK, God knows what it is in the US, and has a huge market share across Europe. So we need to start thinking about the future framework. And I think partnership is definitely the way to go. And in a way that is privacy first. We've lost the battle in Europe. We've lost the battle in California in terms of how we use cookie data, right? It's been lumped in with all this other stuff. And we've lost that battle. And we're not going to regain it. And no amount of sort of a grandstanding by the IEB or people in the industry is going to change that, right? The privacy advocates have won. We need to figure out a way to work around this new ecosystem. And I think it's going to be partnership. It won't be one company controlling them all. And I think the problem we have right now is there's 6 or 7 different IDs trying to stitch up what I call the 20%. You know what it is outside of Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the walled gardens, the smaller walled gardens like Snap and Pinterest are logged in data. which don't do any frequency capping, which don't do any real attribution. And that, the value of the 20% is actually more, because actually that 20% represents so much more time in terms of consumption. So we can figure out a way of mapping that together in a privacy force way, and it has to be privacy force, not legitimate interest, no half-arsed issues, completely in compliance with the ICO and all the DPAs and all of the American enforcement agencies. We have to come up with something absolutely ironclad, right? So that we can still do business in this industry. Because, you know, if we kind of said let Johnny Ryan's and all the rest of them win the argument, there will be no industry, and Google and Facebook will take 100% of the market, and we don't want that. All right. We all have to work in this industry, like, you know.
That's very true. Yeah,
and I think that this is a good. I envisage there's going to be some kind of, you know, remember the Buttonwood sort of coming together, which was where the New York Stock Exchange, so all the traders and merchants in the US came together in the, I think it was early 1800s, and they came under in Buttonwood, and they agreed a standard for the stock exchange in New York. I think something similar is necessary in our space.
Globally,
one ID, and it's commoditized, and it can't be owned by a trade desk or a live ramp. It has to be one ID. And nobody can own that ID. It has to be a anonymous, commoditized piece. I'd love the IEB to do it, but DigiTrust doesn't seem to be moving fast enough. Doesn't have the resource. I don't know where it's going to come from, but there will be a crisis point, because we cannot let... Like, if I'm a brand... I'll give you an example. If I'm a brand with £1 million, right, and I've got a DR aspect to it, I've got a KPI, and I have... All I've got available is The Guardian's anonymous web contextual targeting. Contextual targeting on Guardian's great, but I've got no targeting features. I've got no frequency capping features. You know, I've got no way to measure attribution. Whereas in Facebook, I put it all in, KPIs, all the rest of it, it works. So that's what we're up against here. I've tried to say that to people. We need to find a currency, and it has to be a privacy first currency. And I don't like when one company, it's just like, two lads fighting over crumbs, basically, you know.
Well, yeah, but I guess they all have to have a go to see what will ultimately win out. It's a bit of like a VHS Betamax style situation, isn't it? Despite the fact that VHS, you know, one is marketing not being.
I applaud the trade desk for trying to get ahead of this, but I don't want a company who makes margin out of media owning the ID, because that gives them an advantage.
That's true. There are many naysayers about that for that exact reason.
I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong from an industry point of view. The trade desk can still make money by integrating and offering value. They can't own the ID, because once they own the ID, they can basically tell other DSPs to use me and put people out of business. I'm not saying that would happen, but there is a fear of it happening. And the presentation at Cannes, which Ronan Shields, you know, an alumni of Exchange Wire, wrote in Adweek, it was demonstrating that's what they're thinking. I think that's wrong, but we need to have a conversation, grown up conversation, particularly around all the cool channels like OTT and display and out of home and audio. If we have one ID, imagine the amount of money we could take off those bloody Americans, hey.
I completely agree. I mean, it's less about, you know, having a single competition across all the different players. Why we don't go all get together, try to find a solution and get it right. Because at the end of the day, if now the trade desk did that, but there are other, you know, platforms that are going to do the same.
Exactly.
So it's exactly the same situation. So
we'll have a balkanized, we'll have literally a balkanized ecosystem. Like, it'll be like bits here and bits there, and walks in. That doesn't fly. That doesn't work. We need a unified ID and something that is 100% like ironclad privacy. So no Johnny Ryan, no Swiss assholes can go after this. It has to be solid. And that takes a lot of work. But this is the brilliant time. Where there's a crisis, there's an opportunity, right? We could reshape and remold this whole industry if we got a chance. And I think that we're coming then. I'm seeing people who have never seen now engaging in this conversation. They understand that this is an opportunity.
And plus, to be honest, if I can add one point, you know, advertisers are also losing the trust of all these things that are happening. I mean, they don't get and they won't trust one single platform that can do that, because they will say, well, we're going to find the same things there. So there is never one true voice to say, okay, this actually works for everybody, so let's do it. Because if this company, this tech company, which are not Google and Facebook, keep competing to each other, they're always going to have Google and Facebook there. They're going to always be bigger than them, right? So as if they want to be very competitive and just try to get also a piece of their Google and Facebook cake, they just need to get together. They need to find a way where the walled garden is there, okay, but we can actually figure it out, the user experience, user journey, within each other, without, you know, fighting, because we are going to get the revenue. Because if, you know, advertisers know that, for example, there is one way to get a unique view of the users across all these different environments, let's always exclude the walled garden, they're going to get that. And they're going to spend money, because that's the way that, you know, the market is going.
It's easier.
Easier.
And it's easier. It doesn't take away from what agents do, because then you still have to have different strategies for different channels. If we have one ID, the way you put ads into audio, where you put ads into out of home, the way you put ads into OTT, they're all very different strategies, very different audiences. But like this unifier, this ability to frequency cap, this ability to just do some basic attribution modeling, it's so important in a DR context. Like,
well, these are what we would normally refer to as hygiene factors. They are necessary requirements for any form of media.
Exactly.
But on that note, I need to move us on from your... No, we can't go backwards. You're absolutely right. And we need to move on from your rallying cry, Kieran, there. In the limited time we have left, I want to chat with Simona about what you're up to at Mindshare. In your global remit, kind of how you're driving innovation and how you're working with the local markets to obviously help them to function, operate, activate plans, what it looks like from a kind of a hub perspective into the local markets.
Okay, so, well, again, I'm working from this London hub. And as I said, it could be, as I said to you previously, actually, we could have, I don't know, EMEA, for example, regional hub, or it could be global. So what I'm actually doing with my accounts, with my clients, is try to manage first to understand what is the big picture of the client across the globe, what they're trying to achieve. And this is not just about media. It's also about marketing and business opportunities. I'm a digital lead, so for me it's all about that. So what I'm trying to do, and this of course can much vary depending on the different account, different structure, but what I'm trying to do is first and first understanding what is their need and possibly translate these in all the different markets. There are brands like, for example, consumer goods, so FCMG, where, you know, the transition, the digital transformation is slower. So what we're trying to do is trying to set the brilliant basic right. And then whenever we do that, I'm trying to help the local market to say, okay, what are the different opportunities now to do something a little bit more innovative? And when we say innovative, I hate to talk about innovation and innovation or whatever, but it's more about how we can take a slightly different approach in all our campaign in order to say, okay, these have worked, but let's see if we do these things differently, how it goes. So, you know, I think it's still a win-win, because whenever you test a little bit, there is always a learning curve. So that's what we do. For a more advanced client, and usually it's all about your line businesses, because they are all about DR, they're all about performances and measurement and scale. What I usually do with them is educational, innovational workshop, for example, with them. And this is all related to big topics. We talk about the evolution of audio. We talk about the evolution of video, for example. And this is always in a customized way. So it's all related to their own requirements. So whenever we look at markets, of course, we're going to look at the markets that are more interesting in, but especially also to say, okay, this is the media landscape, but let's go a little bit into the dirt. So what happened actually? So if this is all great, so why digital audio and digital video are a massive, you know, hot topic today, what's the dirt? So what are still the challenges? And now actually the big players are aiming to fix that and address that in the short or possibly in the long term. So that's what I'm doing on a day-by-day basis.
And how do you find, do you find different trends and different challenges from market by market? Obviously, you're working with local markets. they're being told, not told what to do, but that everything's coming to them from a regional or global hub. Are you finding that there's challenges there? Are they very receptive to all of this, or are there kind of different market nuances you have to be aware of?
So I worked in a market before. So I worked in Italy, right, in a media agency. So I do understand sometimes, I mean, most of the time, the frustration that they get usually from the international hub. This is also because sometimes they think, and sometimes it's true, but don't tell to my agency as well, that, you know, the people in International Global Hub, they're just like people that are forwarding information. So we get the things from the market, we get the things from the client, and we just pass the ball to the local markets without even understanding what's happening. So I'm trying to switch a little bit the way of how they think. So what I usually do is definitely I'm looking at my markets. I look at something that can definitely be taken as an example, a standard across different markets. But obviously, I'm giving these guidelines, I'm giving these information and insights. But then, depending on the priority of the markets, I can also sit down with the market and just say, okay, this is what happened, this is the standard. But what are your nuances? The last things that I want for them to do is reacting on everything that we pass through from the global to local market. So they all have different nuances. For example, for some market, I mean, we are in, we talk about global, we talk about Europe. But for example, when we approach Russian market, it's a completely different environment, a completely different landscape. So I cannot just say, guys, this is it. You actually apply and deploy whatever I'm telling you to do. So that's just an ongoing conversation. And that's actually what I like the most about my job. It's because, yes, I can have a look at what happened and I can create standards across the globe. But actually, if you don't have the interaction with the local markets, you will never learn different things, what happened in their space, and how we can actually bring some of the things, cultural or media things that happen in that market, in different markets as well. So, that's
interesting.
It.
Brilliant. And I think it's probably a good time to end it. Before we do end it, I want to remind everybody that it is, don't forget to nominate your ATIT personality and ATIT Rising Star of the Year. They're free to enter. The winners will be announced at this year's The Wires Awards in November. Information on how to enter will be in the podcast description or on Exchange Wires website. But other than that, I want to say thank you very much to Simona for coming in today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you,
Kieran. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Lindsay.
This is Lindsay Roundtree, Exchange Wire, signing off. Goodbye.